Hey, what's up, psychos? Welcome to another episode of Take Your Pills, Psychopath, the comedy podcast that exploits mental illness for personal profit, trademark. I'm your host, John F. O'Donnell. I hope everybody is doing well out there. I hope everybody is holding tight and shining bright, doing as best you can. Yeah, real quick up front, if you can, please support me on my Patreon. It really helps me out a lot. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/TYPP. That's patreon.com/TYPP. There's all sorts of tiers there that you can support me, and it really helps me out. So if you find value in this show, please throw some value back at me. All right. Wow, what an episode this time around. It is with Tristan J. Miller, a great actor and comedian who has put together a solo show about his experiences with bipolar disorder called Manic Impressive, which I am super excited about, which you should be super excited about because he is getting that off the ground. He's going to be touring with it. So we discuss that a lot. We talk a lot about his experiences with manic depression, my experience with manic depression, aka bipolar disorder. We compare and contrast. We explore depression, what that is, what that feels like. We talk about manic episodes, and it's very informative. It's really a great episode, and I think you guys are really going to dig it. I think you're going to enjoy it. So without further ado, please enjoy this episode of Take Your Pill Psychopath with Tristan J. Miller. Hey, Tristan, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing pretty good. Things are looking up, as they say. Well, we'll see. They're looking sideways right now.
Yeah, they are looking sideways. I really hope that things keep going in a positive direction and that we don't have to have some setbacks and stuff like that. So you're in the process of booking a tour. Very exciting. You're going to be taking your solo show about bipolar disorder on the road, which is really, really cool.
Thank you.
And well, you know what? I was going to ask you and check in with you and see how you're doing, but we could do that in a few minutes. Why don't you just Why don't you just tell me what it's been like to put together an hour solo show about bipolar disorder, a disorder that you and I share, but has taken on different forms because it is a very idiosyncratic disease that is kind of an umbrella term. You know what I mean?
Is. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a huge difference between mental health and your personality. Like, it's the whole nature-nurture debacle is what I was going to call it. You know, the great nature-nurture debacle of life.
Yes.
But putting together the show was a process of, like, I was lucky enough to be able to workshop it for about a year, about 2-3 years ago, I guess. And I think one of the benefits is to, you know, being bipolar and doing public speaking and writing is one of the symptoms is talking a lot. So you can, you know, I was able to kind of garner from that, but it was it's been kind of a tricky bit of business to find humor in dark places, but I've also found that I've tried talking about normal stuff on stage and making jokes about like dating and stuff, and it's never as successful.
Yeah, I find with my stand-up to be really personal about things that are initially very difficult to figure out how to make funny. If you can crack the code on it, it really is a worthwhile thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And it's also like I feel like my mind can't sit still, so I can't just stand there and go, "You ever been swiping and this happens?" You know, for me, it's too. There are people who do it and they do it very, very well, and I don't want to knock that. There are some very funny, you know, relationships are a goldmine of stand-up material, right? So I don't want to knock anything that, but like for me personally, I just could never sit still long enough to like talk about like a story per se. So the show is also like kind of scatterbrained, and it also was interesting because I did it for a while, and part of the hour is explaining what bipolar disorder is, right? Because you need context for the jokes to work. And so it gets a little TED talky sometimes, but it's very funny throughout. But like, and for a while it was just that, and then me making jokes about the disorder, and the feedback that I kept getting was like, hey, we also want to know about you and your childhood and like who you are as a person. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't quite land. And so for me, the more difficult thing than making jokes about the health disorder was going, okay, how do I share weirdly more personal things besides my mental health?
Yeah, totally. You know? How do you make it more personalized so people that maybe can't relate to the specifics of the intense mood swings can still relate to you as a person, you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100% context. It's creating context for why I am the way I am. And so that was a surprise of like, oh, I need to explain that I'm from the Midwest, for example, which is something that like I didn't realize I would, because that does, like you were saying, it's, you know, idiosyncratic, but it's very different, you know, obviously for every Midwesterners have a different reaction to bipolar disorder than someone from like, say, the South, you know, or even, you know, you want to go extremes, you know, from, I don't know, Russia or something.
Yeah, that's interesting. Know? Or honestly, even people that are diagnosed with different ethnicities or races in the country because of different stigmas and of being higher or lesser degrees in different communities. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So basically, your process has been to give context to what's going on, figure out how to make the dark stuff funny and get really personal. Mm-hmm. That's exciting, man.
Thank you. Yeah, I when I started doing comedy after the pandemic, well, after lockdown, once they let us started doing comedy in person safely again, there was a period where I was like not doing so well, and I realized why, and it was like, oh, I'm not working very hard at this, like, because I'd gotten used to doing like two things a day. And so another part of the process with this remount of the tour, because I was touring it a little bit before the pandemic, is sitting down, and now the part of the process is physically listening to myself deliver jokes and writing them down and relearning everything. And that's agonizing in a completely new way.
Yeah, that's super challenging. Like, I'll record my sets, but then the fact to go back and actually put in the work to listen to them, to write the things out. I actually do write my stuff out, but then to go back and listen to the sets is actually a very challenging thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've talked to a lot of comedians about it. It's like, yeah, but it's how you know. It's how you know what actually works and what doesn't and why.
Yeah, it's how you find those different beats and stuff like that, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel lucky that I have a couple of, you know, video recordings too, because a lot of it is also like I do a lot of act outs and a lot of it's very visual. So like to be able to remember, oh, I go here and I do this thing, and that I feel very lucky to have some archive footage, essentially.
That's great.
You know,
How if there's anything else you want to say about that process? I was about to ask you how you did psychologically dealing with bipolar disorder during this very difficult time.
Sure. We can move on to that question. I think I did okay. I'm still here. So number one, succeeding. Number two, I had other personal things that kind of overshadowed what I would call like the mental health part of it all. In as much as like I was living with an ex and now we're broken up and I had to move during the pandemic and find my own place and go through a breakup and I live alone. So like all of that was very, I mean, obviously the disorder is linked to it because no part of my mental health isn't, but I feel like I did okay. I tried to give myself projects to work on and let myself feel lethargic when it was necessary, but I'll be honest, the breakup was probably the hardest it was, and that was just normal breakup feelings, not even like, oh my god, you know, the world's ending and I don't have a date, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But I feel very lucky that way, because I feel like the minute when the first case was like confirmed in New York, I was like, I started really mentally preparing myself, like to the point where the job I was working at, like I left my uniform there, my clothes, generally speaking, I took them home because I knew we were gonna, like I was already like doomsday prepping my emotional state, as it were.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm sorry you had to deal with relationship stuff on top of all of that. You know what I mean?
That's
a lot. So you were able to kind of get through it without having an episode. I did pretty well for a while, but then come November, I kind of spun out, unfortunately, and I got really manic and I had to end up in the hospital for a few days. But luckily I had such a plan in place with like friends of mine who already were, I already had them like in an email chain, like in touch with my psychiatrist. So if things started to go off the rails, they can get in touch with her and then she could kind of brainstorm with them how to get me where I needed to be as quickly as possible. And so it really kind of nipped in the bud what could have been a really bad situation, you know?
Well, I'm glad you got the help you needed. I'm sorry to hear you had to go through that, though.
Yeah, it's okay. It was like, I really just got overwhelmed by everything that was going on. And like, I also got obsessed with this group of people. And I talk about this on the podcast still sometimes because I find they're interesting to make fun of now. But I got really fascinated with this group called the World Economic Forum, who it's basically like the Davos group. And basically, they're using this pandemic as a pretense to try to usher in their sort of global agenda, which is called technocracy, which is kind of using technology to try to control every aspect of our lives. And I don't know if they're necessary. They're not necessarily going to pull it off, but I think that I got really, really obsessed with them. And now that I have some narrative distance, I'm like making a web series, making fun of them and stuff like that, which is like cathartic for me, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That absolutely tracks. I absolutely like, I feel lucky because I have such a lower grade of the disorder, that like I absolutely had peaks and valleys over the past like year and a half, and specifically going through the breakup that I went through and living alone. And one might assume that when a breakup happens to someone who has bipolar disorder, they get very depressed. And that's not the case for me. I got very excited and like all this new stuff and like let me go experience new things and this sort of thing. You know, like I bought a bunch of stuff and like I, looking back, I was clearly in like a hypomanic episode of like, oh, okay. Luckily, like nothing bad, too terrible happened at all that I know of.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were absolutely peaks and valleys, and I feel bad because I feel like the relationship stuff was like a really huge instigator of mood because through the whole thing, and I'm getting a little emotional now talking about this because I haven't thought about it in a while. Through the whole thing, whenever something was going bad, like, you know, I couldn't perform stand-up or I couldn't act or if a podcast didn't go well or whatever, or like I just felt terrible, I was always like, at least I have this person. And so when that was taken away, it was, I feel like that's when all the burnout that everyone had experienced in the middle of the pandemic hit me. And that's when all the initial feelings of anxiety and fears and these sorts of things, they really hit hard once that, you know, base was taken away. Luckily, it also made way for a lot of personal growth and realizations about myself that I, you know, didn't know because I was acquiescing to a relationship, which is when you're in a relationship, the thing you know, both partners do. But now that I'm on my own, I'm like, oh, okay, this is why I behave this way. And I actually like this and not this. Does you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. So did you find that kind of anguish and heartache and loneliness manifested itself, you were saying, for you in kind of a hypomanic episode?
Yeah. Like, whenever I get upset, I don't sleep. And, you know, as I'm sure you know, if you don't sleep, then your body is like, the way I kind of describe it is like an immune system. All your brain goes, oh, we're not getting enough sleep. Let me pour out as much energy as I can. And whether that's like exuberant or agitated. It's one or the other. And so, yeah, it absolutely, specifically once I moved out of the apartment we were sharing, since everything was so novel, I got very excited for about a month and a half, and then that came. I moved out in January, and then in February, around February 14th, if you can believe it, I got very depressed.
Sure.
You know.
So how does a hypomanic episode manifest for you? Like, what is that? What does that sort of entail?
A lot of, I feel very lucky. A lot of creative endeavors. A lot of, unfortunately, a lot of purchasing things that I don't need. I started a new hobby over the pandemic, which was really great. Miniature making with Warhammer 40K. It's, you know, it's a tabletop war game, and so I bought a bunch of those figures, and then I still haven't painted half of them because of that. And then just kind of running around like a Looney Tune, being stressed out, and again, living alone, I find I talk to myself a lot, you know, because I'm working things out, and there's no one there to be like, shut up, don't talk to yourself. And so that's kind of a key thing. And the way, you know, and I got, for the first like 2 months I was living alone, I was doing like yoga every day and working out every day and like really trying to build a routine and a regimen. And looking back, I was like, you were able to do that because you had so much energy.
Yeah.
And then now it's like, how do I regulate? Yes, you should still exercise, but not for 2 hours every day or whatever.
Yeah, like know? It was getting a little bit manic and stuff like that. Do you find historically that you'll have depressions first that are then followed by hypomanic episodes? You'll be hypomanic and then you'll fall into a depression? Or is it not necessarily always the same?
It's an up and then a down.
It's an up and then a down, yeah?
Yeah. 100%. And it's, you know, Carrie Fisher said it really well when she's like, one mood is the meal, the other's the check, you know?
That's great.
Yeah. God rest her soul. Yeah. She was phenomenal. But yeah, that's absolutely how it is. It always feels like, you know, I go down the hill and then I have to bike up the other side emotionally. And it, luckily, I'm at a point where I have a routine where I don't think too much about the chaos in my own mind. In as much as I'm on medication that has been working for me for a couple of years, I do therapy once a week, and this is woo-woo, but I meditate twice a day.
That's not woo-woo. So, that's wonderful. That's super helpful. Yeah. Super important.
It is. It really, that is just super. It really helped mellow out my mood. And so I do, like, the way I put it is, like, I think about my mental health for about 5 hours a week, and then I'm able to kind of set it aside. And I feel very lucky and privileged in that position. And also, part of, like, doing the show is letting people know you can be high functioning. You can, it's not, you don't have to be stuck in a situation where you're making yourself unhealthy. And I feel very lucky to kind of gotten to that place.
Yeah, and if you have enough tools in your bag, you can you can stay well, you know?
Absolutely.
And wow, to have the discipline to meditate twice a day, that's really special.
I've missed a couple, but, you know, and some are shorter and some are longer. But it also is like, it feeds into that, like, I'll sort of make concessions with myself. And that feeds into, like, the obsessive-compulsive part of, like, if I do this twice a day, you know, it's magical thinking, but it also is helpful. It's like, if I do this twice a day, it will help. And so I make sure I do it twice a day. Similarly, like, when I'm working out, I found out my lucky number is 5, so I do 25 sets because it's 5 times 5 is 20. Like, and I just let myself have that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But with the – it's funny, too. But with the meditation –
yeah.
It actually shows there is neuroscience behind it. It's not,
oh, you know, 100%.
There's a lot there. That's awesome. Yeah, I was trying throughout the pandemic to have like a regimen with that, with trying to do yoga and trying to meditate. And I did okay with it. I did good for a while, but then it kind of slipped. And now I'm trying to kind of get back into it. But it sounds like you are taking responsibility for your mental health. You know, you have your talk therapist, you're doing the exercise, you're on medication. What medication are you on, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't mind you asking. It's Lamictodrine.
Yeah, I'm on that too, amongst other things. But I'm on that. Sure. That's part of my cocktail.
Perfect.
It's been helpful. Apparently been a medication that's been helpful for a lot of people. And people with bipolar 2 disorder, which I believe is your diagnosis.
That is correct.
That medication along with lifestyle can be a good combination to stay well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been so helpful. My only complaint is that it has thinned my hair.
Okay.
And that's very rare, but it has, and I am very vain because I'm a performer and I have nice hair, and I didn't like that it started thinning. And so getting that situation rectified was stupidly emotional for me because it is, you know, just hair and it grows the way it's going to grow. But I cannot recommend enough trying it out if you have similar neurochemistry to me. Because it was the first, I feel so lucky, it was the first one I tried too.
Yeah.
And it just worked.
Well, I'm staring at your hair right now and it is quite full and voluptuous. You don't have anything to worry about, dude.
Thank you very much. I work very hard to maintain.
It's very voluminous. Voluminous? Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
So over the course of this podcast with different guests and stuff like that, I feel like I've talked a lot about manias, and I feel like I haven't talked about or described depression as much as I'd like to. And as somebody, because they said for a long time, they go like, okay, bipolar 1 disorder is the worst version of the disorder. Bipolar 2 disorder is like a less severe version. But in more recent literature, they're saying that because the depressions of someone with bipolar 2 can be so debilitating and so painful that they don't make that disclaimer anymore, that 1 is worse than 2 or something like that. So I wanted to know if you could speak to, because you know what it is? It's like talking about the manias are interesting, they're funny, you know what I mean? They can be ridiculous, they can be, you know, there can be these bouts of creativity which are interesting, but the depressions are so isolating and they're so painful and they're so lonely and in a way banal, so it's hard to talk about. But I wanted to know if you could talk about what it's been like for that's the sad side of things.
Sure. For me, a lot of the time is the most frustrating part of it is that I don't know what's happening until I'm like really in it. You know, it's like a frog in a pot, because I'm just like, oh, I've just been sleepy lately. You know, I guess I've been pushing myself too hard. And then all of a sudden I'm like having a very hard time getting out of bed. But for me, the main thing, and this is something that like I don't think we talk about enough regarding depression, is the brain fog aspect, which is where you can't cognate very well. You know, your mind is cloudy or foggy, if you will. I just reiterated the thing doctors say. I guess that's the point. Anyway, so.
Yeah, but it's weird. It's because like, and you feel like it's going to stay like that forever, and that you're this reduced version of yourself, you know?
Absolutely. It's like the whole day is, you just woke up and you haven't had coffee yet. That's the whole day a lot of the time when I'm, like, I remember, like, and I'm someone who has had, like, substance abuse problems in the past, but I've, like, had, like 12 cups of coffee just trying to get my brain started throughout the day, and I can't do it. And it's, that part, for me, is very frustrating, because, okay, I'll get to another part of it as well, which hurts me, it pains me, because when one is depressed, well, when I'm depressed, you get pessimistic, you get bitter, you don't think things are going to work out. And for me, as a, again, talking about disorder versus personality, right? As a person, I approach life pretty optimistically. I think things happen for a reason. I think if you work hard, yada, yada, yada. I'm kind of a chipper person as a baseline. And so when that's taken away, not only am I feeling the feelings of depression, you know, the lethargy, the hopelessness, the loneliness and the anxieties, but I'm also feeling frustration with myself. because I know it's not who I am. It's like when you have a big thing at work due and you get a head cold the day of, and you're like, I have to push through this. But as we all know, if you take a day to rest and then do the thing the next day, you're going to feel better. And so the thing I have found is that what helps get through the depression is I give myself 2 to 3 days to just feel awful and just eat whatever I want to eat, sit around, not do anything. And then, much like a cold, it will slowly begin to lift. Rather than if you stretch it out, if you push yourself too far, it's the cold is going to turn into a fever, is going to turn into a flu. You understand?
Yeah.
And so that's sort of how I feel about it. But it is, you're right, it's specifically very lonely and isolating, because you not only feel like people don't want to engage with you, at least I feel this way, of I don't want to, and maybe this is the Midwestern side of me, it's like I don't want to bother them by saying, hey, I don't feel well. Can you come over and can you help? I have a huge problem with that. And so you end up becoming more and more isolated, and it's difficult. It's very difficult. It's also difficult to do shows when you're depressed. There was about when comedy first started coming back, I was running the show and I was depressed for like 2 weeks, and like my sets didn't go any well just because I was so fucking over it, you know? And it's hard to, again, cognate. So, and half of stand-up is thinking, you know?
Yeah, totally. I feel the same way. When I'm in that clinical depression, my brain feels like it's slowed down. A lot of times, too, it's like, you know, our brains are actually healing from having had a manic episode. Because the brain is running on such overdrive when it's in that hypomanic or manic state that then it's kind of in this healing process where it needs to slow down. And I've felt it's the scariest thing to like lose the dynamic, the dynamism of your personality, but remember what it was like, you know, when you were clicking on all cylinders, and be scared that it's never going to come back. And that's how you feel.
Yes.
And it's not true. It's not real. You will get out of that depression, but that's how it feels when you're in it. And your brain at times, it can get so bad that, my brain at times, thank goodness I've never attempted suicide, but I've been convinced that I've had ideations of suicide, being comforted by the fact that suicide was an option. Like, oh, thank goodness I can get out of this sort of thing. Have you ever experienced that?
100%. There's a reason I wear a belt every day. Are you kidding me? At any moment, I have it. If I just need an out, boom, it's there. And yeah, 100%. And like, then conversely, you know, I've had moments where I've been feeling fine, and then a little voice said, you're gonna die someday, and then day's ruined. So I can't I have it both ways. But absolutely, I've sat there and gone, I could, I'm not going to, but I could. And that, it makes you feel better because it is control, because you don't feel in control of your own moods and your own thoughts, but what you can control are your actions. And so I feel like that's where the comfort comes from.
I think that's definitely part of it, for sure. I think it's also your brain tricking you. I think it's part of depression is your brain tricking you into wanting to do something like that. I found for me that that exercise is really the first step towards getting me out of a depression. I don't know if that's similar for you.
It certainly helps. I think it really bothers people that the first line of defense against any mental health condition is, are you drinking water and are you exercising regularly?
No, I know it almost sounds flippant. I know it almost sounds like a platitude, but like really, like exercise is really the way to do it.
There's, you know, a lot of your nervous systems are also like comes from your gut as well, we're finding out. So diet's really important, you know, and so it is crummy to say, but like that's the baseline. You know, if someone who's just feeling crappy in their own life starts, you know, drinking water and exercising, they generally feel a bit better. So, you know, it's the first, that's the base. So exercising really helps. Also, for me, because I'm Protestant, setting a deadline for a work thing does, because I'm like, well, I can't not do this thing.
Yeah.
So I have to get over myself. And then also doing things that are creative, but at my own pace, and creative things that don't have stakes. Like doing stand-up will stress me out if I'm depressed. But if I'm playing piano, my God, I could do it for hours and hours and hours. And because it's just, it keys into that creative part of my brain, but there's no expectations of being good. It's just me. And that really helps. And I think what you said about your brain needing rest is also really important. Jacqueline Novak, she's a comedian.
Sure, I know Jacqueline for years.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense because you were also a comedian. she wrote a really funny book that I wish I knew the name of about depression. And basically, she suggests that in the book, you should just give into it. If you feel terrible, feel terrible, much like I was saying before. And she's the person that changed my mind about that. And if you just let yourself feel bad, not to the point of, like, obviously committing suicide or anything like that, but if you, again, feel sick, let your body rest. Jim Carrey says this corny thing of it's depressed, deep rest, which is fun.
yeah.
But, like, is that true, Jim? I don't know. But, yeah, I think, but specifically music has always really helped me get out of a depression, but never listening to music, always playing it. I have to be doing something. I'm a very active person, even when I'm depressed. Yeah.
Well, no, I appreciate you talking about the depression stuff because it is, it is hard to express, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, and I feel like this interview, we're going in like, and I'm totally fine with that. We're kind of doing it in like a backwards order where first I asked you about your show. Then we got into, you know, how you've been doing most recently. And now I'm going to ask you like the origins of your, which should have been the first question, but, whatever.
Yeah. So, time is an illusion.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what? Play the podcast in reverse.
Oh shit. Just, you hear that? You psychos listening. If you're thrown
it's
off,
be like the Red Room from Twin Peaks.
Exactly.
Let's rock.
Exactly. Yeah, psychos, if you're thrown off by the order of the questions, just listen in reverse.
Paused it.
Yeah, yeah. But so when were you diagnosed? How old were you? How did that episode manifest? What was that like for you emotionally to deal with the stigma of the label? You know where we're going here, dude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I've asked people this exact question. So it was always very apparent, and there's a family history of it. So my mom was always kind of on the lookout for it, and specifically, we were always kind of aware of it. And when I was 16, I went through a very bad breakup, and I went berserk, and I was in what I would now be like, it was clearly a very bad mixed episode where I wanted to kill myself and also like had so much energy and was so angry. And so that kind of made everyone aware of the situation.
Yeah.
And then we ignored it a little bit. I ignored it, at least, I should say.
How old were you when this happened again?
16.
Okay.
And then I went off to school when I was 18, and I was living by myself, and so I didn't really pay much heed to it. But I was absolutely, there was times in drama school where I was like, if I haven't been up for 20 hours a day, I've wasted my day. And thinking about that now as an adult, I was like, what were you? Clearly in an episode. So there were absolutely markers and touchstones. And I was always a very sensitive kid and hyperactive. So that happened, and then I had a long, hard time of, like, I knew I had this thing, but I didn't want to deal with it. Does that make sense? Like, I just didn't want to...
Yeah.
I didn't want to do anything about
it. I had a similar thing where for years and years, I would just sort of like have an episode, get through it, and then just like move forward and not address it, you know. But go ahead,
100%. And like, I also knew what it was. I knew the exact, like, I'd been given enough literature because, again, it ran in the family. My mom like made me aware of the situation, but I still wanted to ignore it. And when I was in my early 20s, I was stomping around and drinking too much and hurting people's feelings and, you know, made a bunch of choices that I didn't agree with then and don't agree with now. And that compounded the whole thing because you feel embarrassed and stressed. Then I moved back home to Minnesota for a couple of years because I was seeing this woman and that didn't work out. And we both ended up moving to New York, but not together, which was weird at the time. But then when I came back, because I'd been away from the city and I came to the city to be an actor and to perform and all of this. And so I was away from that. And I was like, I'm not going to mess around if I move back. I'm going to give it an honest go. Because when I was coming out of school, you know, I was 19 and 20, like, you're goofing around, right? You're not taking things seriously. So when I came back, I was like, let's sort this out. And it started with going and getting a diagnosis, which I did kind of unconventionally. There's a service here in New York. I wish I could remember the name of the place. I need a look. It's on the certificate. I have a I'm literally certified.
Nice.
Where you can essentially get an assessment from clinicians that do it for court cases. You don't have to be accused of anything or nothing. But you can go to their facility and they'll evaluate you. And they're doctors, but they don't necessarily need to, like, prescribe you anything. They'll just give you a diagnosis. So I went and I did that. And then I was like, okay, I have it. I scored very high on the bipolar spectrum because they evaluate for everything. And I was like, that makes sense. But what made me upset at the time, because it's something I'd never thought of before, is I scored incredibly high on the ADHD spectrum as well, which often goes hand in hand with bipolar disorder. But that had never occurred to me, and that really shook me. And I had to kind of process that of, like, I just thought I was, you know, bubbly. But I'll be honest with you, having the diagnosis was such a relief.
Yeah, I'm hearing that from some people, that they're finding that the diagnosis was a relief, is a relief. You know what I mean? Like, knowing knowing what it is and putting a name to it. I guess for me, because I was so young when I got the diagnosis, or maybe it was more stigmatized when I got it or something like that, that it was not a relief. It was like, it was like super painful for many years to even be able to say out loud that I have mental illness without, like, tearing up, you know. But I feel like now that's not as much the case. I think that people are not as dealing with the stigma as much, which I think is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. How old were you when you were diagnosed, may I ask?
I was 19.
Oh, that is quite young to catch that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's, I mean, it can be like teenage, I mean, it can be later teenage years, early 20s, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like 19, 20 years old.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm not going to ask what the year was, but yeah, I would imagine things were a bit different.
No, I don't care. You could ask what the year was. It was, I believe it was, let me think. I guess it was probably the year 2000, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, we were still shaming Lindsay Lohan for substance abuse problems during that time. So yeah, the world was very different.
So you were back to you. So you were you were relieved to get the diagnosis.
I was, because then I could pursue a fix, you know. Yeah. And also, it explained everything that I'd felt my whole life, and I was able to not use it as an excuse, but use it to explain why I was behaving certain ways to friends or whatever. And similarly to you, what were you saying before? You know, I had a group of friends. I'm like, if I start acting this way, please, you know, see to it that I do this, 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 and this. And, you know, I've done, like, in past relationships, I literally handed my ex-girlfriend my credit card and be like, don't let me have this for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. But yeah, I was really relieved at the time because I had a name for it and then it had no power over me. It's like, I know you. It's fine, you know. And I'm not the first person to have this. I'm not, you know, there's that weird, like, I'm not special, so that comforts me, you know.
I think that's great. I think that's great to have that outlook on it. And I know, like, Andrea Allen was on recently, and she talked about getting her diagnosis of bipolar 2 and how she felt good about that to finally know what was going on. My friend Jen Tisdale, who has borderline personality disorder, said she was so, so relieved to finally get it. For me, I was not able to get relief in that respect. I got relief through performing about it, through figuring out how to make it funny and talking about it in an honest way and feeling less alone about it and have people laughing with me about it, like, has been such a healing, saving grace for me. So, like, all these years, throughout the years, when I've had a manic episode and then it's been followed by a depression, for me to be able to have a creative outlet to express this sort of thing, I really feel like it's saved my life. And at the very least, it has saved my sense of self and my confidence and my joy and my happiness in my life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad that you have that. And also found that. How great that you found that and you found that outlet that works for you. That's phenomenal.
I feel very lucky.
Yeah. I feel the same way as you as well. Like, I'd done a little bit of stand up before I had my diagnosis, but then selfishly I was like, finally something to actually talk about on stage and to make it funny and to be able to explain it in a way that wasn't frightening to people, because it is frightening when you go, I'm mentally ill. People kind of go, okay, what are they gonna do next, you know? And if you can say it in a way that is, there's a little bit of a relief there with a laugh, it makes the whole process easier. And that was a huge reason I started stand-up as well, is to be able to talk about it in a controlled way where people were going to be on my side, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. So what are you, creatively, you're doing so many different things. So the plan right now is to you have the show, it's ready to go, and you're figuring out the tour right now? Is that what's going on?
A little bit. I have two workshop shows in Brooklyn on the 6th and 7th of August. And those are shows where I'm kicking off the cobweb. So it's like friends and family sort of like, you know, I've made it public. If you want to show up to it, go ahead. But like, I might have a notebook on stage stuff, you know? And so it's not quite ready to go because I haven't done it in front of anybody yet. But once that happens, I have a series of dates lined up for September. And then I'm looking at later in the autumn and early next year, God willing, to tour it around. And then in September, I'm shooting it as a special here in Astoria in QED.
Nice.
And so hopefully I'll be able to, I'm kind of doing things much like this podcast in reverse. I'm shooting it in September and then I'm touring it. And then if you like the show, you can take it home, I guess. My honest to God hope is that I can continue to tour it through the continental United States, and then by next August, Edinburgh Festival will be able to happen, and I'll be able to take it there.
That would be cool.
That was what I wanted to do in 2020, but obviously it didn't work out. But yeah, so it's good to go, more or less. And what's been really wonderful, and I was so worried for no reason, turned into David Lynch a little. I was so worried for no reason, because I was so concerned about, like, oh, well, I have the show all about bipolar disorder. What will I write about next? And then already I've written new material about having bipolar disorder because my relationship with it has changed, because it's a relationship you know, you have with yourself. And that's all stand-up is talking about yourself in hopefully a relatable way and a funny way. So there's already new jokes and new things, and that keeps me excited and keeps the show fresh, and I'm really excited to share it with people. Yeah.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
So let people know again where the show is happening on August 6th, you said, and 7th?
Yeah, August 6th and 7th at Urban Myth Studios. It's a photo studio that's turned performance space, and it seats about 20 people. It's pay what you can / donating to the venue and the other comedians that are opening for me that day. That's the priority. So if you don't want to pay anything, you don't have to. And again, I do that because it's a workshop show, so I might say a fair amount.
Very cool. Yeah. Can you also let people know where they can find you and stuff like that?
I can, yes. My main source of, I was going to say, internet delight. What is...
That's perfect. Are you kidding me? Yeah. Who would not want to sample your internet delight?
Yes, if you want the amuse-bouche of Tristan Miller's personality, go to twitter.com/TristanJMiller1. Some other bastard has Tristan J. Miller. And for show dates and stuff like that, you can go to TristanJMiller.com. And I also do a couple of podcasts, one of which you've been on, called Positive and Negative.
I have, and it was a great experience. Well, is there, before we go, is there anything mm-hmm. else that you'd like to say? I always just sort of open it up to my guests to say anything that they like.
Sure. I wanted to talk to you a little bit, actually, about the meditation thing, because you had a hard time keeping it, right?
Or just being consistent with it. Yeah, just being consistent with sitting down on the mat and doing it.
What kind of meditation were you doing?
Sometimes I do a guided meditation.
Okay.
And sometimes I'll do just a meditation with, like, bells to remind me to mm-hmm. stay present every, say, 5 minutes or something like that.
Okay. The reason I ask is because I have used, like, Headspace and Calm, and none of that stuff works for me. But I did learn transcendental meditation, and it is a cult. It's fine, but it's I learned it for free, so I scammed them. They didn't scam me. It really did help me, and it really leveled out my mood in a way I was not expecting, because I'm of a class economically where I assume everything's a scam.
Yeah,
that I'm getting ripped off constantly, but it does really help me, and I would recommend it for you as well. You can. You know, not to plug something that's not me on the podcast, but if you go to the David Lynch Foundation, they teach it for free for people who have mental health issues and also specifically targeted PTSD, both in veterans and civilians.
So I've heard about TM, but I don't know too much about it. Like, I'll do guided mm-hmm. meditations by this secular Buddhist practitioner, Josh Korda, who I really love, or by this mm-hmm. woman, Tara Brach, who's also phenomenal. But tell me a little bit about TM and what it is, I guess.
Sure. TM, Tristan Miller. No.
And now for you guys listening at home, we are officially doing this podcast in the most bizarre way, where Tristan has already plugged all of his stuff. And now we're about to talk about transcendental meditation. Why the fuck not? All right, go ahead.
Yeah, live a little. Why not? Why not? You know, it's 2021. There are no rules. Yeah. I just bite straight into the cheese stick. So
it's all good. So go ahead. Tell us about TM, dude.
Basically, transcendental meditation is you get a mantra. It's mantra meditation. It's non-religious, or, you know, it can be or it can't be. But the one I learned is non-religious. You get a mantra, which is a nonsense word. It's a sound or a vibration, a specific one that you repeat to yourself, and this eventually does something to your brain where it's a little tricky to feel to to explain, because it kind of feels like you're going down into an elevator into yourself. You get a really good feeling, and then you settle in really, really nicely. If the meditation is a nice one, a lot of the time you're just sitting there trying to remember to think the mantra, and I'm thinking about five things, and that's also fine. At the very least, it's 15 to 20 minutes where you're sitting and you're just trying to focus yourself. You're not trying to focus. That's not a good way of explaining it. You're allowing yourself to be for 15 to 20 minutes, and then you can begin whatever you're doing. But it's a mantra that you repeat to yourself, and it sort of tricks the brain into an almost sleep-like state. They've done brain scans of people who are practicing transcendental meditation and people who are about to fall asleep, and the brain scans are the same. So it's kind of like that feeling of when you're in between wake and asleep and you're almost daydreaming, but not quite. It's kind of a hard experience to explain, but it's, I think, overall a positive one. And this is, I'll be honest with you, this is the first time I've mentioned it on a publicly. So, you know, that's fun for me, I guess. But it's really helps because it also keeps your neural pathways fresh. It, you know, changes them up, which not only enhances like intuition and creativity, but also in terms of depression and anxiety and mood things. It's almost like the way I think about it is like a natural version of electroshock therapy, where you're getting a little bit of a jolt of something and it creates these new pathways that stop thought cycles that are unpleasant a lot of the time. So.
Wow, that is an amazing explanation.
I'm glad, you know, and if you want to get into the metaphysical thing of like, yeah, you tap into this energy field that binds us, surrounds us, you know, it's, you know, the unified field theory, or the force as it's known in Star Wars.
Yes.
You know.
So is that where potentially cultish stuff comes in, or is it?
Yeah, you can slip into that sort of thing if you want to. It's also, it's not a cult. I say that kind of jokingly. They are doing some really fantastic work, and specifically the David Lynch Foundation is very, I believe in that program. So it's, you know, sometimes you learn it from somebody and they learned it from somebody. So they're not the best teacher and they also charge you money for it. Whereas with the David Lynch Foundation, it's for free and specifically trying to help people who have mental health conditions. I think there are some parts that can be culty, but I don't think, other than the cult of personality that is David Lynch, you know, there's no actual cult there.
Well, that's a great explanation. That's appreciated. So how about that, psychos? At the end of the podcast, you got a tutorial, little explanation about TM, Transcendental Meditation. Which, I'll look more into that.
There's a great documentary that David made about it. You can go, and it's free on YouTube.
It's very true. Tristan, I want to say thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing your story with myself and the psychos. And I wish you all the luck with this solo show. And if you're in the New York area on August 6th or 7th, definitely go check out the workshop of the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please do. And thank you so much, John, for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Yep, talk soon.